My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
It is essential that our team learns to work with our new recruit, not against him.
I'm a geek, walking down the street.
Check the computer.
The mainframe computer.
I access the mainframe.
At the end of this day, one shall stand, one shall fall.
Time to find out.
Welcome to Basically a Geek Show. Here are your hosts, Mike and Jack.
God damn it, Mike.
We're going back to the future!
You've been waiting all week to do that.
Yes, I have.
You fucking ass.
I have, yes.
This is episode 27.
28, actually. 28
of Basically a Geek Show. This is Jack. And he is now my sidekick, Mike, because he just is a fucking troll.
I was debating between that and the Doctor Who theme.
God damn it.
But, we're going to kind of expand on the discussion we had last week. We talked a bit about Warlords of Draenor. And, you know, we've talked about it before, but we're really going to get into the meat of it all now. We're going to touch into some of the canon or Warcraft lore behind it, seeing as, I believe a day or two after we recorded our last show, the cinematic trailer for the expansion was launched.
Yeah.
And, with that came the release date. Congratulations. You were pretty much right on the money with that.
Yep. Well, like I said, you know, they put the assets for the the anniversary shit in the Draenor beta build, so it kind of makes sense from that point.
Mm-hmm.
November 13th will be the release date of Warlords of Draenor.
Mm-hmm.
A lot later than all of us had hoped for. Some of us more optimistic looks for thinking, you know, June, July, August, maybe. Blizzard themselves said that part of the reason for the delay was evidently they hired more people.
With the goal of speeding production up.
Right.
And
but
then
they forgot that they had to train them once they hired them. And so that kind of took a little bit. So there we go. November 13th.
Indeed.
We shall be traversing into the great beyond the alternate universe, the alternate history, not time travel. Of Warlords of Draenor.
It's time travel. Like, however you want to call it, whatever you want, it's time travel.
I'm going to call it me giving you a fat lip.
The trailer starts off 35 years ago.
Yeah, it starts off 35 years ago when.
That's my point. 35. The trailer starts right off the bat, 35 years in the past. This is time travel.
Well, it's showing the point of divergence.
Mm-hmm.
It's establishing its root as a piece of alternate history.
Mm-hmm. But yes, let's get to it. I realize that not all of our listeners might be, you know, versed in Warcraft lore. So I'm just going to give a brief summary of what happens in the main timeline, so that when we go into the trailer, you all have a idea of what we're talking about. Orcs are stupid. Yes, that is consistent across all time streams. Orcs are stupid. But in the original timeline, Draenor is a planet that the orcs live on. It is their native planet. And they live alongside a group of Jewish space goats called the Draenei.
Now, why do we call them Jewish space goats, Mike?
Because their story is basically based off of Jewish history, and they are blue goat people.
And didn't you say they also had kind of like Yiddish accents?
They have Yiddish accents, yes. It's actually quite funny because, each race in the game has sort of like their own built-in jokes. And if you play as a Draenei, and you, you know, you type the joke command, the Janai jokes are something that Jewish listeners might recognize as a form of dialogue we like to call kvetching. So basically constant complaining. So, yeah, you know, they're Yiddish, Jewish, blue goat people from space. And the Janai used to be part of a race called the Eridar. And the Eridar were corrupted by Sargeras, who is basically the Warcraft version of Satan. And he corrupted two-thirds of the Eridar. And the Eridar that refused to follow him became known as the Janai, the exiled ones. And they ran away trying to avoid being slaughtered. And they landed on Draenor. And for a while, the Draenei named Draenor. Draenor means home of the exiles. The orcs never had a name for their homeland, so they just sort of adopted what the Draenei called it.
They barely even had words.
They really did. They, you know, it's just a sad state of affairs on the orc side of things. But for a long time, the orcs and the Draenei pretty much kept to themselves. But then Kil'jaeden, one of the Eridar who embraced Sargeras, found the Draenei on Draenor, and then he convinced the orcs through, the shamans Ner'zhul and Gul'dan to corrupt the orcs. Kil'jaeden brought along with him a demon pit lord named Manaroth, and he convinced, the orcs. Oh, he convinced Gul'dan, who was an orc shaman turned warlock, to convince the rest of the orcs to drink the blood of Manaroth, and that corrupted the orcs, brought them under demon influence, and then the demons instructed them to wage a war of genocide, first against the Draenei, and then they opened the portal to Azeroth, which is the main setting of Warcraft, to wage a war of genocide against the humans.
Now, so, are we sure it was Kil'jaeden and not Arkhamande?
We're going to get into that, but it was Kil'jaeden. Trust me, it was Kil'jaeden. But, okay, so alternate timeline. Well, first, at the end of the Mists of Pandaria expansion, one of the first orcs to drink the demon blood was a fellow by the name of Garrosh Hellscream. Grom Hellscream. And Grom, he was a bit of a chode. And he died redeeming the orcs, but he was still a chode. His son, named Garrosh, became war chief of the Horde, in-game, and then waged a war of genocide, because that's what the orcs do, against the humans. And not just against the humans, but against all races of the Alliance and against all non-orc races of the Horde. So the end of Mists of Pandaria, the combined forces of the non-orc Horde and the combined forces of the Alliance deposed Garrosh.
Orc Hitler,
yes. And then Garrosh is put on trial, but then the Bronze Dragonflight, who have the power over the Timeways, they send Garrosh back in time, 35 years in the past, to the moment, to just before Gul'dan is about to convince the orcs to drink the blood of Manaroth. And Garrosh brings with him future technology, and he not only convinces the orcs to not drink the blood of Manaroth, but he unifies them in the Iron Horde with the plan of invading future/present Azeroth so he can exact his revenge on those who deposed him. And, the trailer sort of gives that story. It shows Grom Hellscream rejecting the demon's blood. He kills Manaroth, kind of imprisons Gul'dan. And then, you know, he's like, we won't be slaves to demons, but we will be conquerors.
And Grom talks like the Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah, he does.
Totally.
Yeah, he does. And he looks very piggy.
Harness the power of Destrucity.
Mm-hmm.
Unleash the power of the Puma gods. Puma.
Yeah. It's an interesting trailer. There's a lot of hype for it because Blizzard does CGI cinematic trailers very, very well. They've got a lot, good quality, you know, the history of quality stuff. And so there was a lot of anticipation for this one. And I think, both you and I had the same reaction. It was like, we were just kind of like, eh.
Yeah, I mean, okay, now, artistically, quality-wise, it was everything you would expect from Blizzard.
It was I'd say in terms of the art style and the rendering and the visuals, I'd say it's probably the best one they've done.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, artistically, it's beautiful. I would love to see Blizzard just try their hand at doing a full movie.
Yeah.
Like that. I mean, it would be epic. Now, I've heard a lot of mixed feelings on this trailer. Of course, there were about the Miss Pandaria trailer as well, which I actually kind of liked because it was kind of funny and, you know, whatever.
It was kind of funny, and at the same time, it, you know, it told us really everything we needed to know about the expansion. I mean,
I guess in a sense, this one is too. I might be biased. It might be me just kind of groaning internally and being like, more bloody orcs.
Yeah.
Orcs. That might be part of it.
Blizzard
and,
loves their orcs. And,
you know, big surprise, the expansion about, you know, going to kill orcs has orcs in the trailer or in the cinematic. You know, I shouldn't be surprised. Maybe I shouldn't be about it. You know, I'm willing to admit my own bias in this case. I don't know. I would have liked to have at least seen, had like a scene of, you know, the Alliance and I guess the Horde too, if you must, you know, coming through the portal at some point and just, you know, ass raping everything in sight. Not literally, that would be for the parody cinematic World of Warcraft. but yeah, you know, it would have been cool, but I get why they didn't do it. I understand why they did what they did with the trailer. It shows the point of divergence. It sets the premise for the expansion up. And of course, orcs are prevalent because, well, that's what we're going to go kill. I get all of that. It still left me feeling kind of eh. And you're right. Grimash looks very pig-like.
Which yeah. I just wanted to say that traditionally, you know, fantasy literature has its roots dating back hundreds, if not thousands of years. And orcs are a very old staple of fantasy literature. And originally, orcs were depicted as pigmen. And obviously, you know, depiction of orcs in Tolkien, in the Warhammer series, in the Warcraft series, orcs have kind of evolved into something not so obviously pig-like, but Grom was looking very piggy here. And I don't know if that was just the way that the art, you know, panned out, or if it was an attempt to maybe reference that older style of what an orc is supposed to look like. But, you know, it is worth mentioning because I've seen a lot of people mention how piggy he looks.
And he had very beady eyes, very small, beady little eyes, like disproportionately.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a thing characteristic that Blizzard has done with the orcs. It seems to be just with Grom they've done that, really. Like, I thought Garrosh looked kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
It almost, he in a way looks familiar. Like I'm trying to think like what actor he, like his facial features kind of reminded me of, but I can't, mm-hmm. I can't really peg it. But I mean, it all looks really good. It's, you know, it basically goes back to the point of divergence where, you know, Gul'dan cons, Grom/Grimash. Which they changed the name for reasons unknown, allegedly licensing, which I don't really get because whatever. Anyways, you know, where he had them drink, the demon's blood, the fel Kool-Aid.
Fel Kool-Aid, yes.
Yeah. And, you know, in this alternate timeline, Grom has already talked to his son from the future. And when he's offered the tainted, herpes-filled demon blood. He's like, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and not do that.
Yeah, the original timeline, Grom is, like, eager. Like, Gul'dan's like, who's going to be the first to drink? And Grom's like, I will! And he drinks it. And then, but you know, here, his son from the future has already, like, come back and warned him about it. So when Gul'dan offers it, he's like, so what's all this about? You know, what's this all about, guy? Come on. So, yeah. That is most definitely interesting. My reaction from it came from the fact that we already knew this happened. At BlizzCon, when they announced this expansion, they said right up front, the point of Divergence, Garrosh goes back in time and prevents his father and the rest of the orcs from drinking the demon blood. They right. said that. That has not been a secret. We've known that happens since day one of this.
I'm going to do devil's advocate on this one and say, all right, well, look, like, okay, Cataclysm, mm-hmm. which actually opening cinematic-wise and only opening cinematic-wise is my favorite. But, I mean, we knew Cataclysm started at the point Deathwing, you know, broke free from within the Earth and flew around all over the planet just wrecking shit. But yet in the cinematic, that's what you see, even though we already knew that happened. Burning Crusade, well, you knew Illidan was going to be in there, and I believe Illidan was in the cinematic for that, and it showed the Burning Legion and all this other shit.
Illidan was there being emo, because that's right. what he does.
But you still seen that, and Wrath of the Lich King, I mean, you knew it was about Arthas and all this other shit, and yet it still shows him doing his thing. So, I mean, and the only one that really showed something that we didn't kind of like know had happened or whatever was Pandaria, because that was almost kind of like, I don't know, maybe supposed to be like the first alliance and horde soldiers to have set foot on the island, maybe, mm-hmm. or something. And kind of like what went down with that encounter, maybe, which they later on released kind of like an epilogue to that, where it shows the human and the orc drinking it at a bar together, like, I don't believe the shit I just seen. And they'd forgotten all about killing each other, and they're just getting drunk and questioning their sanity.
Yeah, the human's like, so it was a bear? And the orc's like, with a hat!
Yeah. again, yeah, it's why the Pandaria cinematic got a lot of shit. Oh, it's Kung Fu Panda and Herky Derky Derk. I liked it. I mean, I liked the expansion. I liked the cinematic.
Mr. Pandaria is it's weird. Mr. Pandaria seems much maligned, but if you actually ask anyone who's played it, they generally admit, no, it was good.
Yeah, and the thing is, okay, now this new cinematic, it's gotten mixed reviews. I mean, you've got the people like me and like here kind of like,
the thing is though, and it's like, okay, with Cataclysm, yeah, the trailer was just Deathwing blowing shit up, but that was sort of the be all end all of that story, you know, Deathwing invades and blows shit up.
Right.
But we've got an alternate timeline here. There's so much more to explore. I would have liked to have seen something maybe with the orc assault on the Draenei, or maybe even the besieging and destruction of Nethergard Keep.
Maybe. Now, there are unfinished cinematics in the beta, mm-hmm. And you might get to see some of that maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, like, the thing, I think the target demographic for this audience are the old, like, hardcore players from BC mm-hmm. and shit like that. And cause I was, you know, just poking around on the YouTubes and the whatnot, that those players think this is badass. You know, this is Warcraft getting back to its roots. This is, as Blizzard likes to say, all the time, putting the war back in Warcraft, and yet okay, they never really seem to.
It's getting Warcraft back to its roots by changing the root story?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, no. I mean, yes. I mean, we don't even know anymore.
No, something I wanted to point out is that for the longest time, Horde fans, specifically Orc fans, would defend the orcs as a race, saying, you can't blame them for the genocide of the Draenei because they were under the influence of the demonic blood and whatever. Well,
that they chose to drink.
Which, you know, one, they chose to drink. Yeah, no one's, you know, even in the original timeline, you should have been able to look at Gul'dan and figure out this guy's not on the up and up.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not exactly subtle. He's all hunched over in his evil-looking warlock garb, being like, drink.
It's like a guy. Yeah, it's like a guy selling Rolexes out of the back of a 72 Chevy van in a back alley in New York City.
Yeah.
I mean, something's up with this shit.
Yeah,
Come on.
Yeah, Gul'dan, he's like, he's got like red glowing eyes. He's in like this evil warlock outfit and he's like all hunched over and like all Palpatine looking and he's like, drink, hell, scream. Like, even before Garrosh showed up to, you know, warn them about this, someone should have been like, guys?
Yeah.
Something about this doesn't seem kosher.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, but yeah, you know, a lot of people said, oh, well, you know, they were under tainted influences and, you know, Mike and I have said on the show a few times, well, okay, well, in Pandaria, fucking Orc Hitler, Garrosh, which Blizzard knows he's Orc Hitler. They even named the last wing of his raid Downfall, which is kind of a misnomer because they did not once do a fucking parody rant, and that pissed me off.
Yeah, I wanted to see the Hitler rant parody of Garrosh, where he's got all of his generals around, and like they could make Sarfang, who's one of the orcs who doesn't like him, they could have made him Fagaline.
Yeah. Eitrig is a yodel. Shut up, Baldy! I object to you objecting to my plan to plan! But, yeah, you know.
But, yeah, but between Garrosh trying to wage another war against the Alliance and the fact that in this new timeline, the orcs are still trying to kill the Draenei even without the influence of the Demon Blood, orcs... Just fucking assholes.
Yeah, I mean, cause, you know, when Garrosh was running the show, you know, A, he got a lot of support from other orcs. I mean, not all of them categorically fell in line, no. I mean, all the Germans didn't fall in line with Hitler either. But, you know, this just shows that orcs don't need demon blood to go on a rampage. And now Blizzard is reinforcing the point with this expansion. You know, they are deliberately saying, okay, no, they have not drank the blood. And yet you have, you know, Grom saying, okay, well, we're not going to be slaves, but we're still going to be dickholes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, through the portal they go, hi ho, hi ho. And so, I mean, you know, this whole noble savage thing. Is quickly falling apart and being just left with the actual noun here instead of the adjective. They're just savages.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Indeed. I mean, you look at the, even in the original timeline. In the original timeline, what happens is Kil'jaeden goes to Ner'zhul, who's sort of their spiritual leader, and says, hey, those Draenei guys, they're plotting against you. You should go kill them. And the orcs just believe it, even though the Draenei have done nothing
right.
at all to show that they have any ill intention towards the orcs.
They're just standing in line for their coffee.
Yeah, exactly.
And they you know, they're not fucking with anybody.
Mm-hmm. No, and it's just, Yeah, no, there are a few orc characters I like, but they are irredeemable bastards, and at least they're open about, as characters, about being irredeemable bastards. But characters like Grom Hellscream and Orgrim Doomhammer, and even Durotan, you see people say, oh, you see Horde fans say, oh, they're noble. No, they're not. Each and every one of them took part in the unprovoked genocide,
right?
Of another, you know, sentient race that was no threat to them, and so this just sort of reinforces the idea in my mind that, you know, orcs, yeah, you know,
and the
redemption story that they tried to push with Thrall, it's been Mists of Pandaria shot it through the heart, and Warlords
Which
of Draenor,
pissed off a lot of Horde players, actually.
Pardon?
Which pissed off a lot of
well,
Horde
you know,
players, actually.
Well, you know
actually.
What? Cataclysm pissed me off when I had to follow Thrall around. So,
yeah.
You know, as far as I'm concerned, they can suck on it and deal with the fact that the game is pretty much telling them that their faction is wrong.
Well, the thing is, okay, look, you know, Mike and I have no issue with rooting for the villain, with liking the villain more than the protagonist. We've done it. In fact, him and I these days tend to do it more often than not. So we don't, what we're saying basically is, if you're going to have a villain in your game, good. I mean, the game needs villains. It needs that sense of balance, and it needs that yin and yang and whatever. But let's not make any mistake about what we're dealing with here. They're not noble savages. If you're going to like them for what they are, just bloodthirsty, kill everything, genocidal maniacs.
My favorite character on the Horde side of things is an orc by the name of Blackhand. In the original timeline, he's actually the first war chief of the Horde. I think that's not the case in Warlords of Draenor, because that kind of goes to Grom here. But Blackhand is known as Blackhand the Destroyer. Okay? There's no gray area there.
Yeah.
And you know what? As far as orc characters go, yeah, you know what? I like him. But I'm not going to go and tell anyone that, oh, he is a noble, misunderstood savage. No, he's a fucking asshole.
Yeah, and he's got a flaming shirt, for Christ's sakes. His shirt is on fire.
And he named his sons Rend and Maim.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, come on. Come on, guys. Orgrim Doomhammer, asshole. Grom Hellscream, both timelines, asshole.
Yeah.
Durotan, not much of an asshole, but he still did some assholish things. So,
yeah.
You know, but again, if you want to root for the bad guys, go, fine.
Have at it.
Just be honest about it.
Yeah, I mean, have at it. Like, you know, on the forums, the Horde players that I can, you know, be like, yeah, you know, I get what you're saying, are the ones who say, you know what, I kind of liked having Garrosh around because he was a good counterweight to the Alliance. Mm-hmm. And everything was very clear cut, and, you know, it offered more of kind of like an alignment choice for the players. You know, you could choose to be the Alliance, who are the quote unquote good guys, or the Alliance still has their share of shady people, or you could be the much more clear cut choice of the Horde, which were just undeniably assholes and ran by a genocidal fascist maniac. And you know what? That's a good choice to have, in my personal opinion. Mm-hmm. From a lore standpoint, at least. Now, I get, you know, maybe it's a choice Blizzard made because they wanted to appeal to more people. And everyone's not like us and can't, you know, root for a bad guy or say, hey, you know, I'm playing a villain. You know, I'm turning heel for this one. Mm-hmm. Maybe they can't do that. And, yeah, I could get that. Maybe that's kind of where they're coming from with it. But, you know, that being said, the cinematic was cool. In sense of what it did and what it told, I just kind of wish they had chosen a little bit of a different focal point to demonstrate. Kind of like what you said, maybe show that for a brief moment, and then just show the, you know, or at least wrap it up with like the portal turning red. I would have loved to have seen the portal slowly turning red. And, you know, some poor bastard at Netherguard Keep just shitting himself as, you know, fucking wave after wave of these fucking assholes just floods through.
He was on his coffee break.
Yeah. Commander Tippet, we're coming through the portal. It'll be fine.
Commander Tippet, supervisor of Netherguard Keep.
You had one job, Phil. Watch the fucking portal.
There are orcs in Netherguard Keep, Phil.
Goddamn orcs in Netherguard Keep. So,
yeah.
And there was some other interesting news about Draenor as well that was put out there. We do know now, for example, who the final boss of the expansion is going to be.
It's
going to
be this actually kind of came as a shock considering what was said at BlizzCon, and it is Grom Hellscream, War Chief of the Iron Horde, is going to be the final boss. Now, This was revealed, I think Tom Chilton did an interview.
Yeah, he did several actually, because they had GamesCon going on in Germany, the same time that all this other shit here in the States was going on.
So Tom Chilton, I'm not sure what his title is, but he is a higher up at Blizzard, in the creative department. And, you know, he did several interviews, and he revealed that Grom Hellscream is the final boss. And this is interesting, because the final boss of Mists of Pandaria was his son, Garrosh Hellscream. And when the story for Warlords of Draenor was sort of laid out for us, people asked, is Garrosh going to be the main boss again, because he's the one who sets everything in motion? And Blizzard said, no, it's not going to be Garrosh. In fact, Garrosh is actually going to be dealt with fairly early on in this expansion. But some people are like, oh, well, is it going to be Grom then? And they said, it's not going to be just an orc.
Well, now I admit I have not done my journalistic duty in this. I have not looked up the exact quote, because honestly, in my defense, that would involve me sitting through probably about 2 to 3 hours of BlizzCon footage again to find the quote, to see, because, you know, you're not going to remember exactly where it was put, really. So I don't know whether it was, some people say that they said it was not going to be an orc, and then other people are saying, well, no, the actual quote was not just an orc, which you can take to be different things. I mean, not just any orc, Grom Hellscream, super orc, or as in like the plural sense, an orc and something else. Mm-hmm. Not just an orc, or not just any old orc, and he could be like fucking Felroid Rage by that point or some shit. Because Tom Chilton did say, and this is what kind of, when they first said Grom is going to be the end boss of the expansion, the movie Beowulf from, I think it was like 2005, kind of said it all on that, when Beowulf's like, must I hack down an entire family tree of demons?
Mm-hmm.
It was like, you know, incoming for next expansion's end boss, Garrosh's granny, Grandmosh Hellscream.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, I mean, the thing that makes this interesting in my mind, because, you know, we already had to beat a Hellscream in the last expansion. I think it's that they said that there's going to be heavy Burning Legion being the forces,
yes,
of Sargeras, basically the forces of demons in the Warcraft world. They of course, they're peeved that that the orcs didn't drink the demon blood like they were supposed to. And all they've said is that the final raid will have heavy Burning Legion influence. My prediction is going to be that by the time the final raid is released, the Iron Horde will have been dealt with in Frostfire, in Shadowmoon, their factory in Gorgrond will have been dealt with. And so by the end of the expansion, the Iron Horde's going to be in a real tough place, and I think maybe by the end of it, Grom calls up Gul'dan and was like, so about that demon blood offer.
Yeah.
Basically, he's going to be backed into a wall, and he's going to end up drinking the demon blood anyway.
Which, actually, now that we're talking about it, you know, and this is going to sound weird coming from me, but it would be kind of cool, actually, if they took for like the ending of the expansion, almost had kind of an Empire Strikes Back vibe to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the sense of, you know, we kill Grom, okay, great, but the Burning Legion, like in the cinematic, once you wax Grom, you know, it shows the Burning Legion coming through, driving everyone out, and then pouring through the fucking portal, because now they realize what's actually happened. You know, oh, okay, so this is why our plan to get the orcs on our side fucked up. These idiots from, you know, a different timeline came in and fucked with our shit, and then they come through the portal.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just leaves on that note.
That would be interesting. The Burning Legion, That would, of course, say that we'd have to deal with the Burning Legion in the next expansion. And I'm not sure what their plans with the Burning Legion are. They've set hints that at some point we're going to go to Argus, which is the Burning Legion's headquarters in the cosmos. I am firmly convinced at some point we will have an expansion where we actually go to Argus and fight the Burning Legion. But I don't know if they want to do that yet. And doing something like that would imply that the next one is Burning Legion focused, and I'm not sure if it's going to be. I really don't. But
yeah.
I just also wanted to say on this whole thing that all in all, despite everything seeming like just more orcs, I'm looking forward to it actually. I think it'll be fun, but it definitely seems like filler in a lot of ways. Like Blizzard really wanted to be self-indulgent and be like, oh, we'll get to see all of these orc heroes. And that's kind of the feeling I'm getting from it, that because this is wrecking with the lore. I mean, you have people who are just poring over every detail of Warlords of Draenor's backstory and finding every inconsistency from the main timeline, even stuff that shouldn't have been affected.
Right.
And it's like, at one end, I understand, you know, don't lose sight of the forest for the trees. Like, you don't want to be so anal retentive that you can't just enjoy a good story.
Right, exactly.
But at the same time, it seems like Blizzard kind of needlessly went out of their way to screw up their own backstory just to sort of be self-indulgent here.
Yeah, and, you know, Blizzard has said on a few occasions, that, you know, to the players, you know our lore better than we do. And man, is it showing. Mike and I mean, we're not lore scholars. He knows probably a little bit more than I do on certain aspects of it. But, you know, there are people that know 10 times what Mike and I do. They could almost have a fucking degree in Azerothian history.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just picking this thing to pieces. You know, I made a joke earlier about Archimonde being on Draenor instead of Kil'jaeden, and that's something that Blizzard did, like, as Mike said, you know, in the lore. Kil'jaeden was the head honcho on Draenor when it fell, and he's Sargeras's number two guy, Sargeras being the head guy in charge of the of the Burning Legion. But now in Draenor, it's Archimonde. And when confronted with this, Blizzard said, oh, well, about that, yeah. We didn't have a working Kil'jaeden model ready yet, so we just threw Archimonde in there. It's fine. You play a game. You like.
Yeah.
And the funny thing about that is Archimonde and Kil'jaeden are both Eredar. Physically speaking, though, not identical. One is blue, one is red, and there's some, you know, there's a few distinct facial differences between the two, but you could get they could have gotten away with just like palette swapping. Turn Archimonde's model red, maybe throw some different clothes on him or some shit. Put him in there. People would have still noticed. People would have still bitched, but then they would have said, oh, well, we didn't have a finished Kil'jaeden model, so we based it off Archimonde, but it's still Kil'jaeden. And then people are like, well, we don't like it, but okay. Instead of what we've got, which is like, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, such an easy fix for that, I would think. I mean, I'm not a programmer, but I would think that'd be an easy fix because God knows Blizzard has no issues with the palette swapping shit.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, after seeing that, we're lucky we're even getting Gul'dan in this and not the fruit vendor from Orgrimmar.
Yeah.
Well, we could have made a Gul'dan model, but we already had the fruit vendor orc, so here you go.
Yeah, and they did put in a new Gul'dan model. There's still, and you know, maybe the Archimonde model is a placeholder. I mean, maybe they will finish a Kil'jaeden model between now and release.
Mm-hmm.
It is possible, I suppose, but you know, I don't know.
The problem is that all the text that's been data mined that deals with the Burning Legion mentions Archimonde, so.
Well, that's an easy, it could simply be a matter of just, you know, finding and replacing a word, which I'm sure they can do hopefully I would think they could do on a coffee break. I mean, I can do it on something I write in 5 or 6 seconds. So I would hope that Blizzard has the same ability that Microsoft Word gives me. Though, you know, I mean, maybe I'm setting my sights too lofty on this one.
Yeah.
For too much.
But one thing I wanted to touch on before we move on to the Lords of War was that in that same interview, Tom Chilton kind of revealed, because the book War Crimes, a Warcraft novel that sort of bridges Mists of Pandaria to Warlords of Draenor, in that book, it's revealed that Raytheon, the son of Deathwing, and the only uncorrupted black dragon in the world, that he and Kairos, who work for the Bronze Dragons, who maintain the time streams, that those two are were the ones who were working to free Grimash and Garrosh and send him back in time. And people were speculating what the reason could be, and Tom Chilton gave his answer in this interview. Basically, Raytheon knows that the Legion will try to invade Azeroth again, and so he had this plan to go back in time, stop the orcs from drinking the demon blood, and forge them into an army that could actually fight the Legion.
Right.
And to do this, he sent the bitter sociopath Garrosh Hellscream.
Because why not?
And then Garrosh Hellscream betrays them when he instead uses the newly unified Iron Horde to get revenge instead of actually fighting the Legion.
Imposter brew!
And I'm just saying, in the book War Crimes, right before his sentence, right before Garrosh's sentence is about to be passed, they ask him, Garrosh, do you have any last words? And he says, so then to the along the lines of, the only atrocities I regret are the ones I did not yet get to commit. I'll kill you all!
Seems legit.
And so Raytheon saw him and was like, that's our guy!
Yeah, I like the cut of his jib.
Exactly.
And that's another reason why I was kind of thinking, you know, maybe at the end of this expansion, it would be kind of cool if, you know, Raytheon's been babbling on like a fucking madman about this whole pin burning Legion invasion. It would make sense from a storytelling standpoint if they had this action in some way actually enable the Burning Legion to invade. Like a self-fulfilling prophecy, Raytheon is so obsessed with this idea of a new Burning Legion invasion that his actions bring it to pass.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
You know, he sets up this new portal for Garrosh to go through, and what ends up happening is, Garrosh and Grom are defeated, the Alliance and Horde are pushed back, and the Burning Legion comes through the fucking portal. Oops there, guy.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Kind of what I was thinking with it.
Indeed. Now, on that note, we're going to move on to Lords of War. So, the expansion is called Warlords of Draenor. So, people might be wondering, either people, you know, who came to World of Warcraft, because most of these characters, most of these so-called warlords, have been either dead since the start of WoW, or were killed very early on in WoW.
Yeah.
So if you're someone who didn't play the RTS games, or if you're not all that familiar with the lore of it all, and you're just basically someone who came into WoW, you might be thinking, oh, who are these warlords? Like, why should we be so scared of these guys? And so Blizzard has an animated series called Lords of War, where they basically explain on the backstory. I think they've announced 4 episodes, so I don't know if they're going to go into all of them. But they've announced stories for Kargath Bladefist, Kilrog Deadeye, Grom Hellscream, and Durotan. Those are the 4 so far. Don't know if they're going to do more or not, but those are the 4 that they've announced. And it's going to be set up in a framing device. You see, during the first war, when the orcs, in the original timeline, when the orcs first came, they came through the burning, the dark portal, and they sacked and destroyed the kingdom of Stormwind. And, the King of Stormwind was killed, and his son, the Prince, who was around, I think he was like 8 at the time, he and the refugees from the kingdom fled to Lordaeron, and then the alliance was formed, and the orcs were defeated, and Stormwind was reformed, and now Stormwind is at the center of the alliance. And so that prince, named Varian, he's now King of Stormwind, and he's sort of the head honcho in charge of the alliance these days. And so the framing device of this animated series seems to be that Varian is having self-doubt because the very warlords who sort of sacked Stormwind when he was a child are back. And he's not sure what to do because his father failed so spectacularly. And he's being consoled by Murad, who is a Draenei paladin, one of the Draenei who fought against the orcs when the orcs waged their war of genocide against the Draenei on Draenor. So Murad knows who these warlords are, he knows their histories, and through that framing device of him advising Varian, we're going to learn the backstory of at least 4 of these warlords. And the first one that was released along with the expansion trailer was Kargath Bladefist. And as far as I know, he's the only one, his has been the only one that they've released so far. So.
Yeah, I checked today, or at least late last night, I believe. I checked today's too. And yeah, that's the only one so far.
So we only really have one to go on. And, I guess I'm gonna break this into a 2-part discussion. The first part being, what did you think of the framing device? How do you feel about them using Varian and Murad in this way to sort of explore the backstory?
Well, at least we get to see Alliance characters on the screen.
Yeah, that is nice.
granted, they're only there for a few seconds before they start, you know, telling us about orcs. But, you know, they're there, and that's novel. that kind of sums up my opinion. I think it's cool that we get to see Alliance characters, but it kind of sucks that they're just being used to tell us the history of fucking orcs.
I will say that, okay, I've joked that this expansion is just an excuse for Thrall and Garrosh to deal with their daddy issues. And it turns out Varian's got daddy issues too. So that was kind of the first thing that I took away from it. It was like, wow, every major character in this expansion has this really not so great relationship with their father, or have some sort of trauma related to their parentage. You know, Varian's all, you know, Thrall is all like, I need to live up to my dad. Grom is, I need to live up to my dad. Garrosh's like, I need to live up to my dad. And Varian's like, I hope I don't live up to my dad because he kind of sucked.
Yeah, I hope I don't fuck up like my dad.
Yeah, but I didn't mind it. It makes sense in a way.
Yeah, it does.
Murad knows who these guys are, and Varian doesn't. And Varian, obviously being the, you know, Supreme Alliance Commander, would need to know about these guys. So, you know, that makes sense. It makes sense to me. It doesn't seem forced or anything. It seems natural.
Yeah, no, it doesn't. And that's just kind of me nitpicking, I guess. Again, a little bit of that bias creeping through. Mm-hmm. No, I get it. And I am glad that they're doing this again, because the shorts that they did about Emperor Xiao Hao were evidently pretty well received, and with good reason. They were pretty cool. So they, you know, they're doing more of it. So, you know, that's good to see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I didn't mind that too much. I liked how Murad, like, just, like, throws his hammer on the war table and, like, knocks Varian's action figures over.
Yeah, man, why are you gonna be knocking the man's action figures over?
Yeah, but onto the actual story of Kargath Bladefist, I guess. What did you think of the animation, the kind of graphic novel, stop-motion comic book style that they seem to be using?
Well, it's the same type that they used in in the story of Xiao Hao or whatever, I forget what they exactly called it, but it's the same style that they used then, and it's effective. It means that they can put these out a bit quickly, not spend a whole lot of resources on it, which is cool because, you know, they only have one art department, and if they're doing this, then they're not doing something else. So it's cool that this is both effective and that people like it, and that it doesn't seem to require too much of a drain on their art department to put these out. And they seem to be able to do it relatively quickly, like one every few weeks. So that's awesome. As far as aesthetically, how I like the art style, normally I'm not the biggest fan of it. I don't dislike it. I don't really like it either. I'm paying more attention to the story than to the artwork, which is, I guess, probably partly what their aim is kind of at, I guess. The visuals meant merely to be something to look at while you listen and just moving around enough to keep you looking at it and keep you listening.
I liked it. It's got a very stylized, style, but it kind of took its limited nature and made it an asset. It kind of owned what it was.
Yeah.
And try to exceed its own boundaries. And I thought, like, the story was interesting. I mean, Kargath Blaefus is basically Orc Spartacus. Spartacus, his story eventually ended with execution and a bloody death, whereas Kargath apparently actually won. So good on him for that. But, I got to admit, Kargath is one of those that I really don't care about in terms of lore. He's just sort of there, as far as I'm concerned. He's a background warlord, so, you know, I really wasn't all that excited to hear his story, but I thought it was well done. I'm looking forward to Grom, and I'm looking forward to Durotan. Kilrog is another one I really couldn't care less about, so. I really hope they do more. I want to see Black Hands.
Did they say that they were going to do Black Hand?
They said that they've only announced four. Kilrog, Deadeye, Kargath Bladefist, Grom, Hellscream, and Durotan were the four that they...
They said that they weren't going to – they did say that they're not going to do all of them because they only want to do ones that are quote-unquote integral to the story.
Mm-hmm.
Which I kind of wish they would have left Durotan out because he's going to not end up really being someone we have to fight. So it would have been cool if they just kind of left him out and, you know, put in someone like, you know, Ur-Zul or Blackhand or Gul'dan.
Well, the thing about it is, okay, Blackhand was the war chief in the original timeline that sacked Stormwind.
Yeah, which makes it kind of stupid that they're not doing him as one of the first ones.
You'd think that Varian would want to know everything about him.
Right.
And so, and, like, I don't know, like, Kargath and Kilrog, like, I just don't care about those guys. I really don't. I really, really don't. I mean, you've got Gul'dan, who corrupts the orcs. You've got Ner'zhul, who is the one who lets the Burning Legion sort of get a foothold. You've got Blackhand. Those three are much more interesting, I'd think. And those three I really want to know more about than, you know, Kilrog, Deadeye, and Kargath Bladefist, who really just don't do anything for me in terms of interest. But... again, I liked the art, I kind of like the direction they're going with it, and at the very least, I'll be interested in seeing Grom's and Durotan's. Because, Grom, because he is going to be the main villain of this thing. And Durotan, I'm interested in seeing how they deal with him, because they've been really pushing Durotan as sort of this noble orc lately. But in the original timeline, the timeline that Murad is familiar with, Durotan took part in the genocide of the Draenei. So it's going to be interesting to see if Murad's version of events with Durotan sort of lines up with Blizzard's noble orc image that they've been pushing lately.
Yeah.
So that will be interesting. That will be interesting. But I think, unless I'm missing anything, that's pretty much it for Warlords of Draenor.
Yeah, no, that pretty much covers it. You know, and again, we have talked a little bit about some of these things, but they came out with a lot of shit in the last week, so we knew going into today that we were going to have to spend a good bit of today's show going over everything. So yeah, that pretty much covers our Draenor stuffs.
Mm-hmm.
So just kind of doing the very clunky and awkward segue onto the next topic, Ninja Turtles.
I have not yet seen it. I'm going to be seeing it later this week. But, Jack, you've seen Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. And I guess we're going to, let you have at it. I guess, first question, very broad, general thoughts. What did you think? Terrible, good, somewhere in between?
In between, more bordering. I could not call it good. I definitely could not call it good. It had a few things kind of saved it from being terrible.
Okay, such as?
I liked how they tried to at least give a little bit more characterization to the turtles. Mm-hmm. Than some of the previous live action movies did. Well, like the second and third of the original live action series.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually, for example, Donatello, you know, he's very obviously the tech guy. Whereas in the first movie, when I say the first movie, I'm referring to the first live action movie from the early 90s that was done by Jim Henson. The quintessential measure by which all turtle movies should be measured against. But, you know, whereas in that movie, they kind of tried and that they put out that he was more intelligent than the others, possibly in a different way, like a book smart kind of way, where he would always make the awkward comments when they were trying to joke around and shit. And he would just say something that he was trying to relate, but it just kind of went over everyone's head. So they kind of did it, but not really in that movie. And in this one, it's full out. Yeah, he's got the fucking, your stereotypical Hollywood trope, hacksaw's abilities and all this other shit.
He can hack the interwebs.
Yeah, he can access the mainframe and do the computers.
With the firewalls.
Yeah, you know, and shit like that. So that was cool. Splinter, they did some cool things with Splinter in the sense that he actually fights and he's actually good at it. Whereas, you know, you always knew that he had to be because he taught the turtles, but it's never been demonstrated very well before. I mean, you had that brief blurry scene in the first movie from the 90s where Shredder charges at Splinter. Things happen, Shredder goes over the side of a fucking building into a fucking garbage disposal. And you know, I've seen that movie, I don't know how many times, and I really still can't tell what the fuck happens there. Like, it goes by so quick, it's like, things happen, he's over the fucking building. Okay, that happened, alright, cool. But in this movie, you actually see him and he's fighting and you know, it kind of reminded me of what they did with Yoda in the Star Wars prequels. You actually get to see the master do his thing and be all badass and shit. And I liked when they did it with Yoda and I liked it when they did it with Splinter.
Mm-hmm.
It's nice to see, you know, the older guys who kind of seem to be more like the has-been kind of a thing, even though I'm not referring to either as a has-been, just too old to really do what they used to, is that's kind of how they're always portrayed. It's nice to see them actually not being too old to do what they used to could do and doing that, being badass. So I liked that aspect. Contrary to what I thought before, Shredder is not a white guy.
Mm.
He actually is Asian, which, you know, I thought was cool. I really didn't care that much when I thought Shredder was going to be the white guy. I forget the actor's name. I it didn't bother me that much, I guess. It just seemed kind of weird. Like, why? I mean, was Ken Watanabe unavailable? Let them fight.
Tell me,
but
is Shredder Ken Watanabe?
I don't think so. You never see his face.
Oh, you never? Oh, okay.
No. You never see his face. You just see that he is pretty badly burn scarred. And that's really about all you can get off of him. That, and he's kind of a bastard, but you know, Shredder does tend to be a bit of a bastard. They did, I guess you could say arguably did a good job at not overly sexualizing Megan Fox in this movie.
Hmm.
You do get a few decent ass shots in the tight pants, but no more so than you would any other movie. And a lot less than you would get in, say, like Transformers 1, where she was basically softcore porn.
Mm-hmm.
So you didn't have that. The action scenes were pretty well done, very well done, actually. And, of course, the CGI was, you know, the actual rendering was top-notch. I hate the designs of the new Turtles. And I think pretty much everybody else does, too,
mm-hmm.
for the most part. Like, they just look, and, you know, I guess some people say, well, they're mutants. Of course they're going to be deformed. Do they have to, I don't know, they just look fucking retarded deformed. Like, I don't know. They just look, I mean, with the exception of like Leonardo and kind of Donatello,
mm-hmm.
because, well, of course Donatello's got the big fucking goggles on anyway, so it's kind of hard to tell what the fuck he looks like. And maybe that's a good thing. Michelangelo is the ugliest of them all. I don't know what they were going for with him. He just looks... he looks just flat out fucking weird and retarded. I don't know how hideous. Mm-hmm. I don't get why that. Who thought these looks were a good idea? I don't know.
I thought that they, from what I've seen the trailers, it seems that they look very hunched over.
Not really. That they're actually very physically imposing,
mm-hmm.
especially Raphael.
Mm-hmm.
Which I did kind of like that. That aspect of him. But no, they're like, okay, in the first movie, you know, the Turtles were actually kind of short. You know, they were like, you know, maybe 5'5", 5'6", looked like, if I had to say. But in this movie, no, they're pretty fucking tall. I would say about my height, which, you know, I'm like 6'7".
Mm-hmm.
Raphael, I'd say, would be a good maybe 7 feet, possibly. And they each have kind of like a different frame to them. Donatello's a bit, not scrawny, kind of skinnier. Raph is just huge and bulking. Leonardo is more like the super fit, semi-bulky athletic type. And Michelangelo is kind of the shorter one. But, you know, they at least gave them, you know, they didn't use the cookie cutter approach that the Turtles have had with their appearance forever, mm-hmm. Which I thought was pretty cool. That's one thing they did right. Characterization-wise, they fucked up Raphael.
How they fuck up Raphael?
Okay, so Raph has always been like the kind of asshole of the group, you know, not so much the asshole, kind of like the likable asshole.
Mm.
And it was just always an understood thing that's just how he was. He wasn't really that much of an asshole. He just expressed himself differently and thought differently. He had more of a prideful, stubborn streak than the others did. And that was just something that never needed to be said. It was shown through his actions.
Mm-hmm.
And you got it. Well, in this movie, they fuck it up. Like, okay, at the end of the movie, spoiler alert, derp, derp. At the end of the movie, you know, this tower's falling over and they're all on it and they're all like, oh my God, we're going to fucking die. You know, and as they're plummeting towards the ground in the final bit, Raphael's like, If this is our last moment together, I want you guys to know that I'm sorry for being so mean to you, and I've only done it because I love you so much, and I respect you all so much. What? My God. They fucked him up. Like, you know, they could have, if they wanted to have that moment and maybe have it make the same impact without ruining the character, they could have said, you know, guys, you don't suck nearly as bad as I thought you did. Or something like that. I don't know. You know, I didn't write the fucking movie. They didn't pay me to write the fucking movie, though they should have. I probably would have done better, though they probably would have had me remove a bunch of the dick jokes. But, you know, and to me that just really, I'm like, my God, you know, they fucked up Raph. I don't know. Like, okay, in the first movie, there's where Raphael got the shit kicked out of him, and, mm-hmm. you know, he's laying there and he's almost dead. And you know, when he comes to and Leonardo's like, oh my God, Raph, you're awake, you're awake, you're awake. And Raph's just like, Leo, relax, will you? You know, it was just kind of like, yeah, chill out, I'm here, whatever. But you could tell in the tone of his voice that he was happy that his brother was glad to see him back and all the other shit. And there was that, it was conveyed through tone and mannerism. Even with fucking animatronics from the 90s, it was better conveyed than with the fucking Hallmark moment mush that they had this, you know, super high rendered, articulated, whatever the fuck you want to call it, CGI model blurred out, vomit out in the last few moments of this movie.
Mm.
And, you know, Raph has always been my favorite turtle. I find him relatable. But they just fucked him up. And it kind of pissed me off. Now, Michelangelo, they got pretty much, for the most part, spot on in terms of personality, Donatello, Leonardo. Raphael was really the only one characterization-wise that I thought they just kind of fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
And they had done okay with him up until that point.
Now, you mentioned that Megan Fox was not overly sexualized. In general, though, how was she as April O'Neil?
Non-offensive. I mean, I've never really given a shit about April O'Neil, to be honest with you. I know a lot of the hardcore turtle fans out there will be like, oh my God. I've never really given, she was always just kind of there to facilitate the story. Mm-hmm. She was kind of like, you know, a plot mechanism, in as much as turtles have ever had a plot. She was a plot mechanism. She was kind of like the link to the outside world that they could learn about things and act on them. She was the device that, you know, well, how do the turtles know about such and such and such and such? Oh, well, April O'Neil knows, and she's a fucking newscaster, so her nose is up everybody's fucking ass, you know. And so it worked like that, and they kind of kept that dynamic alive here too, with a little bit of expansion on it. Like in this movie, the turtles were her pets as a child, basically.
Really?
Her father had been working on a research project with this guy. His name in the movie is Sax, who turns out to be the guy who's working for Shredder.
Okay.
The white guy that we thought was Shredder initially, or that I thought was Shredder, mm-hmm. Was working with him to develop this mutagen. And April's father thought it was like a thing to cure all disease, whereas the bad guy was making it as an antidote to a disease that he wanted to unleash on New York to kill everyone and then say, hey, I got the antidote. Pay me all of your monies. Or as he said in the movie, and that will make me just, and he pauses, stupid rich. Which I thought was kind of funny. That was one of the better moments of the movie. But yeah, in this movie, the turtles were her pets. It shows them, it shows her, you know, on like a film clip that she had taken when she was a child, you know, naming the turtles, and they all had like little color coded dots on them, of course, that were painted on.
Really?
Yeah, because they were test subjects for the mutagen.
Oh,
so that was how they pulled apart. And, you know, but there was a fire started in there, which was caused by actually April's father. When he learned what was happening, he decided to torch the whole fucking place. And so she actually, and for some reason, this is kind of like one of the plot holes. Like she's never like, well, I guess to an extent at one point she kind of had that aha moment where she's like, oh yeah, but you know, you would think you'd remember that.
Indeed.
And like, it just seemed like she really didn't remember it until she's like looking at these videos, and then like she goes down to the sewers, and she, after she watches the videos, she kind of draws the connection in her mind as to what happened. But you would think she would get it before then, because it, like throughout the entire first like half hour of the movie, she's like, oh my God, these seem to be turtles. How could this possibly be? And it never occurs to her until she looks at that shit. Oh yeah, my father was in top secret experiments with mutating fucking turtles. You know, duh. But yeah, as far as what I thought of her portrayal of April O'Neil, I thought it was fine.
Is Casey Jones in it?
No. sadly. And he was my, next to Raph, he was my favorite part of that first movie.
Casey Jones is the Canadian Jason Voorhees.
Casey Jones is fucking awesome. Fucking love him. And I always liked the cartoon too. He was always pretty fucking hilarious. But, yeah. So it was a decent movie again. I don't know. If you can catch it at the matinee price, like if your theater does a thing where like, you know, on a weekday or a Sunday before X hour, you're in for like $3 or $4 like ours does, then yeah, you know, it's worth it if you don't buy popcorn and just, you know, fucking smuggle in some stale pork rinds or some shit. Then it's worth it. It'd be worth a Redbox rental maybe, or just catch it on FX for free in a few months. Shredder, you know, a lot of the things that have been said about Shredder is he's a robot made out of knives. And I would like to actually correct that. It's a guy in a robot suit that is made out of knives. I don't know. It's like they shoot out of his hands.
From what I've heard, it's like knives just materialize on his body.
It seems to be even more absurd than that. It's almost like he shoots them out and they come back. And they just perfectly dock back into place on his suit. And he throws them again, it seems like. But they only show them like doing the boomerang thing and coming back and like once. And it's very quick. And it's kind of easy to miss, or maybe I'm just imagining that it happened. But like with a lot of Michael Bay movies, you know, he didn't direct them, but he produced it. The action a lot of times is a bit too fast to really see what's going on, which makes me think that they kind of do that to hide mistakes or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I got the impression that the knives flew out, they got to wherever they were going, and then they – you know, he could call them back or they just came back to their own or something like that. So I don't think they actually just like materialize out of his suit, though it does. I can see where it would seem to be like that and it definitely feels like that. I don't think that is actually what's happening though.
I've also heard that he looks a lot like Megatron from the Transformers film series.
Yes. Well, not a lot, but there are definite similarities. There are definite similarities there. It could almost have been like a thing from Transformers movie where a guy's like, hey, you know, what if I could make a suit out of this shit? And behold, I am Shredder-tron. And, you know, doing that shit. I could easily see that being a thing. It does have that Michael Bay look to it in a lot of places. With the way the action is done and somehow some of the shots are done. It's not overly prevalent. It doesn't, like, I don't know, Battleship had a much more Transformers-esque look to it than this movie does. But you can still see similarities there, here and there with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to the movie's detriment, necessarily. I mean, the movie still kind of has its own feel. Or maybe it's just a feel to the movie that applies well to the source material. But it doesn't hurt the movie any. That's not one of my gripes about it, really.
Okay. But you mentioned plot, and you're telling me about the plot, last night, and I gotta say, it sounds super generic. Like, Shredder, you mentioned, the plan is, kill everyone in New York with a disease and then sell the antidote to the rest of the world.
Well, okay, there's two ends of this plot.
Mm-hmm.
There's the Shredder end, and then there's the – I think his name is Paul, character's name or something. Then there's his end. Shredder wants to control this antidote to basically bring the world to its knees and him become supreme ruler of all of the things. And Zax wants, in his words, to become stupid rich. And hey, you know, the man calls it what it is. He's like, yeah, I just want stupid rich. and this is how I'm going to do it. And, you know, I can respect that. I have no issue with that aspect. Okay, I will say it's a bit of a better plot than Shredder had in the first movie from the 90s, where he was just like, you know what, I'm going to have a bunch of kids steal shit.
Yeah, wasn't he just like recruiting teenagers and being like, yeah. Like, hey, yeah, guys.
He really, I mean, and I've seen this movie a lot of times, but I don't remember, I don't really think Shredder ever was actually stated as having an end game.
Just like, he's just an asshole, like doing shit.
Yeah, he just had these kids fucking stealing shit for its own sake. And I mean, I guess he was trying to make money, like start this organized crime empire or something, which for me, like, it always kind of seemed kind of petty of Shredder. You know, now he's like an up and coming crime lord in New York as opposed to, you know, trying to take over the world. So I'll give the nod in that sense to this Shredder, because at least he's up there with like Bond villain status now. Mm-hmm. I mean, the man's got an end game. He's got a plan, and it's not just having fucking kids steal stereos. You know, it's something. And encouraging underage smoking, of course.
Ah, of course, yes.
So, you know, at least it's not that anymore. Don't smoke, kids. They kill you with pleasure.
But be a survivor, don't smoke.
But, so yeah, I mean, there's that. I don't know. It's like you said, it's kind of generic, but a generic Shredder plot for a turtle movie is actually a step up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'll say in terms of like the villain aspect of things, the turtle aspect, this movie was a step down, but villain wise, this movie was a step up. Because Ninja Turtles 2, the only other one that I really remember, I've watched the third one. Like,
they go
once.
Back in time to like,
yeah,
feudal
like
Japan.
Feudal Japan. Yeah, yeah, and I watched it, and I think I've watched all of it. I don't know. That would have been like within the last maybe 5 or 6 years that I would have watched that. And, cause I didn't see it in the theaters, because I remember, cause my mother, when I was a kid, I'd never really been into the Ninja Turtles. And the movie came out, and she's like, hey, you want to go see the Ninja Turtle movie? And I'm kind of like, yeah, sure, why not? You know, whatever. And we go see it, and both of us, her included, you know, really fucking liked it. And that was actually what got me kind of into the Turtles to begin with. It was that movie, because it was awesome. And we went and seen the second one, where Shredder's endgame plot is roar revenge. Okay.
The second one also had Vanilla Ice in it.
Goddamn Vanilla Ice.
Is Vanilla Ice in this one?
Not that I noticed.
Is there a ninja rap in this one?
Not in the sense of it was in the first movie, where it was like the sound. Of course, I really didn't listen to the soundtrack because I knew it would be kind of rappy.
Go ninja, and, go ninja, go.
And,
go ninja.
I'm fundamentally genetically allergic to rap. I have, okay. For the listening audience, I have a medical condition. It's called fuckets. And some things cause my fuckets to act up. And rap is one of those things. Like, if I'm exposed to rap for more than a couple of minutes at a time, I will start spouting horrible things that you never want to hear at people. And I will do anything necessary to make it stop. If this means, you know, I don't know, putting a puppy in a blender, I'll do it just to make the rap stop. So, you know, to my knowledge, there's this one scene where they're going, this is before the final fight with Shredder, which, surprise, takes place on top of a building. You know, they do this kind of impromptu, like, improvised rap thing in the elevator on the way up.
That sounds horrible.
It's it's not really, it's kind of cool in the sense, it's not cool for what they're doing, it's cool in the context, from a characterization standpoint, because up until that point, they'd pretty much done nothing but bitch at each other. And this is kind of like the moment where they realize, okay, let's actually try to work together for a change, kind of a thing. And this is where Raph's kind of stops telling Leo to shut the fuck up every time he says something. And he's like, no, you're the leader. You tell us what to do. Which I thought, you know, I did not contribute that to the ruining of Raph, because even in the first movie, you know, Raph realized, hey, you know, he is the leader for a reason. I have my thing. He has his, and I'll follow him so long as it suits me to do so. And that's, you know, that's cool. You know, in the context of the scene, it worked, and I actually kind of liked it. It worked for what it was.
Okay.
Now, one thing that reminded me of, now the last scene, like I said, does take place on top of a building where they fight. You know, the final fight. I thought it would, and this is kind of funny, in the original movie, when I first seen it, I was kind of upset that they didn't have the Turtles beat Shredder, that they had Splinter do it.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, 15 years later, however long it's been,
20.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Okay, yeah. So 20 years later. I'm thinking, you know, it would have been kind of cool if they'd had Splinter beat Shredder as an homage to the first movie.
Now, does Splinter die?
No. No, okay, he does not.
The trailers give the impression that he's offed rather
early. The movie gives the impression that he's offed rather early until they save him with the mutagen. They get the mutagen, and it's got super healing properties, TM. And they, you know, stick some of that in his butthole or whatever the fuck, and he's good to go after that.
Okay.
And the first movie had Domino's plugs. This movie has Pizza Hut plugs.
Pizza Hut got in on it this time, huh?
Yeah. And though, you know, I can't bitch. It's nothing as gratuitous even as, you know, the loving pan of the camera across the Bud Light bottles in Transformers 4. It's nothing even like that. Like, they show a Pizza Hut box, and they do linger on it for a bit. But it's not in the context, like, okay, it's a turtle movie. There's pizza. Awesome. Whereas, like, just random Bud Light plugs in a Transformers movie, you're like, what the fuck? So at least in this movie, it makes sense. And it's like, okay, that's kind of – it's actually kind of cool because there's got to be pizza in the movie. Sweet, delicious pizza. Anyways, so, you know, it works, and it was Pizza Hut, and it's like, okay, well, there's one change I noticed, but whatever. Pizza Hut's good. Actually, I like Pizza Hut better than Domino's myself, to be honest with you, but. Mm. So that's pretty much, I mean, my overall take on it. it's, in terms, I wouldn't even, My main overall beef with this movie is still the turtle design.
Okay.
It's just actually, like, off-putting. Like, to the point where, like, Michelangelo looks so derp-tarded that he could fucking, like, scare a kid, man. I mean, I don't know what the fuck they were going for.
Well, from what I could gather, and again, I've only seen the trailers, but in the trailers it looks like they give some of them, like, human-like noses.
They try to, I think. What can I say about that? I think they try to. I think they failed hilariously bad. And that's really about all I can say.
Okay. Well, I guess that's sort of, you know, honestly, that's actually one of the more positive things I've heard, because honestly, I've heard, like, people call this, like, the worst kind of Drek.
It's not. I mean, it's got its fun moments. It really does. It's not a waste of 2 hours.
Okay.
Not an utter waste. It's worth it to sate one's curiosity, whereas there are movies like Dragon Ball Z, which some people were dumb enough to go see in the theater, that aren't even worth that. I liked it better than I liked Spider-Man 2.
Wow. Okay.
It's better than Iron Man 3 because at least Shredder's fucking Shredder.
Shredder and not, you know, Ian Anderson?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's move on. 2 nights ago, we recorded this on Tuesday, so on Sunday night, WWE had their second biggest pay-per-view of the year. Now, we already kind of did a review of WrestleMania for our 10th episode. Pretty much was our 10th episode. We're going to do a review of SummerSlam. We're not going to go in as in-depth into SummerSlam as we did WrestleMania, but I do want to at least talk about the main event. Main event, of course, pitting the unified world heavyweight champion John Cena against Brock Lesnar.
You know, if you called people randomly and did that voice, you would be put on an offender list. I'm just saying.
So, the storyline for this has been, okay, basically, Daniel Bryan won the world title at WrestleMania 3, defended it for 2 months, and then had neck surgery and has been out indefinitely as he's, you know, worked to recover from neck surgery, worked to recover strength in his arm, all that stuff. So Daniel Bryan, stripped of the world title, was put up for grabs in a ladder match at the Money in the Bank pay-per-view. John Cena won that. And now, in the storyline, Triple H, who is basically the new Vince McMahon in terms of story, he's the head honcho calling the shots on the show. You know, he doesn't like John Cena. So he...
I can agree with the man on that one.
So he has basically hired...
Goddamn mariachi band.
He's gone out and hired Brock Lesnar to deal with the John Cena problem. Brock Lesnar, of course, is a, he debuted in the WWE, right after, almost about a year after winning, the heavyweight NCAA wrestling championship in university. So then he went on to the WWE for 2 years. He was pretty much the big guy in WWE for 2 years, got 3 world title reigns out of it. Until he left, apparently the scheduling, the full-time scheduling of WWE is too much for him. So he went, tried out for the Minnesota Vikings football team, didn't make the cut, but then, you know, got into MMA fighting, got into UFC, became a UFC heavyweight champion, which I actually found immensely amusing. Because UFC fans can be quite snobby when it comes to wrestling. Oh, they're not real, like, fighters. And then this pro wrestler came in and, like, won the UFC title in his third fight. So that was kind of fun to see. And then, of course, Brock's retired from UFC, and he's kind of back to the WWE. And like, his whole past with UFC being kind of legitimizing him as a fighter, his NCAA wrestling credentials... He's basically just been billed as this unstoppable monster. He ended The Undertaker's undefeated streak at WrestleMania. And,
You suck!
And he just went right after John Cena. And it was really interesting, because I don't think I've ever seen this before. Like, we've seen squash matches before, obviously, where, like, one guy just has absolutely no chance. But we've never seen it in a world title match. At least I can't recall ever seeing it in a world title match. And I've never seen it happen to a guy with as much of a standing in the company as John Cena. John Cena has been the guy in WWE for the past 10 years or so. Coincidentally, the past 10 years where Brock Lesnar was not in the WWE. So, like, they come out, they have this match. and it's not even close. John Cena eats an F5 30 seconds in. He kicks out of it, but I think he got maybe 5 moves of offense in the entire match. It was basically 16 minutes of Brock Lesnar just beating on him. I think he gave him 16 German suplex body slams over the course of the match.
Yeah, it was pretty fucking insane. I mean, just you've seen a lot more wrestling matches than I have. I've never seen anyone be body slammed rapid fire in succession like that ever.
Kurt Angle back in his prime, back before his body start, like Kurt Angle's body is in complete disarray. He's in bad shape physically. But
now, did you know that he once won the Olympics?
But Kurt Angle, back in the day, back when he was wrestling for the WWE, WWF, WWE, back when his body could still go, he could roll off those German suplexes about as quickly as Brock did. But I don't think he ever gave – in fact, I know for a fact he never gave 16 to one person in a single match. In fact, I think the previous record holder was Scott Steiner, who I think gave someone 8 German suplexes in a single match, and this doubled that.
Yeah, that was it was a fucking sight, man. I mean, I know this shit is about as real in plot wise and, you know, unpredictability wise as a fucking episode of the X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual physicality in a lot of cases is very real. And you know Cena is fucking hurting for certain after that shit.
Yeah, I mean.
He's probably still in bed.
Choreographed or not, he was still dropped on the back of his head 16 times.
Yeah. He's probably hearing his fucking mariachi band after that shit. And you could tell, like, those looks on his face, I'm pretty sure that was not faked because, I mean, he's like, Mommy, I don't want to go to school.
Yeah. No, there's this one sequence where Cena gets a bit of offense in. He hits his finisher, the attitude adjustment on Brock. He covers Brock for the pin. Lesnar kicks out at 2. And then John Cena is like, fuck, that didn't work. And he rolls into the corner and he's just struggling to keep his eyes open. And then Brock just pops up and he stands up and he just starts like jogging in place. He's like, come on, I can still go. Come on.
Yeah, and there were a lot of times when, you know, Cena would just bust out with everything he had, and Lesnar's reply would be just to fucking laugh at, literally just laugh at
like,
him.
Like, laugh at him, knee him in the gut, and then throw him to the ground.
Yeah.
Like, it was like, your pitiful attempts at offense offend our Viking space lord, Brock Lesnar.
Yeah, it very much had this feeling to me of almost like Rocky fighting fucking Ivan Drago.
Mm-hmm.
Except in this case, Rocky was an annoying little jit.
Well, the theory though is that, from what I've heard, is that and again, nothing has been confirmed, but there's a theory going around that from now until WrestleMania 31, they're basically going to play out the plot of Rocky IV with Lesnar as Drago, Cena as Apollo Creed, and Roman Reigns is going to be Rocky.
So is Daniel Bryan just completely out of the picture now? Is he actually like done?
Well, the thing is that there have been people speculating that Daniel Bryan could be an interesting opponent for Brock Lesnar, because Daniel Bryan being not very physically imposing would be the ultimate underdog thing. Like, we threw him against Brock Lesnar.
Right, but didn't they already kind of do that?
Not to someone to the extent of Brock, so it could still be done. The problem, though, is that Daniel Bryan just had neck surgery, and by all accounts is recovering very slowly from it.
Yeah.
So even if he were to be healthy by the time WrestleMania 31 came around, do you really want to risk his long-term health by having, like, Brock Lesnar just suplex him 16 times?
If it meets my amusement, then yes.
Like, I don't know. I would be wary that Brock Lesnar giving him one German suplex would, like, cripple Daniel Bryan. So
let's just cripple Roman Reigns instead.
Well, Roman Reigns isn't a 5'3" vegan. So he could probably handle it.
Oh God. Fair enough.
I mean, Daniel Bryan, all the props to the world. The guy is a fantastic pro wrestler. And god damn it, he makes you care about him when you watch him. And I am not opposed to him getting another world title run, especially considering that, you know, his current one was kind of cut short for reasons beyond his control. You know, doctor says you need surgery, you need surgery. But, you know, putting him against Brock Lesnar just for his own safety. I mean, again, yeah, all choreographed, all staged, but at the same time.
You go in the ring with him, he'll kill you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I fear for Daniel Bryan's well-being if he's in a match where Brock Lesnar drops him on his head. But, yeah, no, this was really interesting to see, because you don't see squash matches for world titles, and you don't see guys of the status of John Cena doing squash matches. Hulk Hogan never got hit, like, the crap kicked out of him like this. The Rock never got the crap kicked out of him like this. Goldberg never got the crap kicked out of him like this. Stone Cold never got the crap kicked out of him like this. You know, the big stars don't do this. And so, in a lot of ways, props to Cena for agreeing to go out there and do this, because most guys, like Hogan, wouldn't even do this in his 50s. And John Cena's still in the prime of his career, and he was willing to lay down for him. So, props in that regard. But just in terms, in the kayfabe world, like the world of the make-believe where it's all real, god damn, this was a beatdown. And as someone who's been sick and tired of John Cena, the character, oh, this was cathartic. This was cathartic to watch, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have liked to have seen Lesnar say something like, I'm going to shove those fucking trumpets up your ass. And then do it.
Well, I would have liked him to have wiped his ass with that stupid towel that he had. Said never give up on it.
Never give up.
Yeah, John Cena's now got his own branded towels that he... And he's been doing it for a while now. About the last maybe 2 months or so, where before a match, he like holds up this towel and it says like, never give up. Now, of course, you not being a regular fan like me, not watching as much of the product as I do, you were a bit taken back when you saw what was on Cena's sweatband, right?
C-Nation.
C-Nation. What do you think about C-Nation?
Man, to say that's reaching a bit, that's an understatement. It's self-parody, actually, is I think the word for it. It's self-parody at that point, made all the more hilarious by the fact that I don't think it's being intended as self-parody.
Mm-hmm.
Just, my God.
Hopefully C-Nation was burnt to the ground, hopefully. He wasn't actually at Raw last night, which was kind of disappointing. I wanted to just see what John Cena would have to say for himself after just getting the crap kicked out of him.
He was probably at home fucking drinking his dinner in a fucking smoothie form.
God damn it. It was just... Oh, it was just Brock Lesnar just beating the crap out of him. It was, again, cathartic if you're like me. And I suspect I'm not alone, because since they unified WCW and WWE titles back in December, the champion has been carrying around both belts. But SummerSlam was the last night that they were using the old logo, the scratch logo that kind of made its debut during the Attitude Era in the 90s. And they debuted the new logo on Raw last night, and so the WWE title belt had the old logo front and center on it, so they introduced a new belt. The WCW big gold belt has apparently been retired for good. Now we're only going to get one world title, and so during that segment, Brock Lesnar comes out, and he's got the world title, and they present him with the world title. And I just would have liked to see John Cena attempt to run in to ruin that and then just get, like, tossed out of the ring. But again, like I said, I suspect I'm not alone, because as they're presenting Lesnar with the new title belt with the new logo on it, the fans are chanting, "Thank you, Lesnar."
Yeah.
So
thank you for ending this reign of mediocrity.
Yeah, no, it was, I mean, if you look at the narrative, and again, John Cena became huge when Brock Lesnar left WWE around 10 years ago. So in terms of a narrative, it's kind of like Lesnar leaves, Cena rises and becomes like the company guy. And then Brock came back because he was bored and was like, nah, I'm going to show you where you really stand.
Yeah.
And so, but now the big question is, where do they go from here? Exactly. Because, partly because Lesnar kind of left them high and dry 10 years ago, they've been really reluctant to build anyone else up. And so they've kind of got a lack of star power to really challenge Lesnar. Roman Reigns, I think, is the plan for WrestleMania 31, but that's still like 8 months away.
Yeah.
So you gotta have something for Lesnar to do, from now until then. And, who else really is there? There's Randy Orton, I guess. But
what about Bautista?
Bautista would actually be great, because even though Bautista doesn't have the fighting credibility that Lesnar has, he's still a big enough eye that if you put him in the ring, it would look like a fair fight. But outside of that, I don't know, like Kofi Kingston maybe? Like Kofi Kingston, if he challenged Brock Lesnar would probably toss him 14 rows into like the stands. Like 14 actual rows. Maybe some of the other former Shield guys, Dean Ambrose, I think would actually make a good program, because Dean Ambrose's character is that he's just cray cray. So like, but of course it's very possible that he's being written out of, the product for a couple months, from the way the Raw ended last night to go film a WWE movie. Because WWE movies are always the mark of cinematic quality.
Oh, yeah.
And so Dean Ambrose is going to be gone from that, which is a shame, because I've really been liking his character. And he's crazy enough that, you know, he would go up to Brock Lesnar and try to start a fight, even though he would have no chance of winning it. But, like, again, WWE wouldn't be in this position if they actually bothered building up some stars for the past 10 years, but they've been so reluctant to do that. Everyone else just sort of looks like this, well, it's a term. It's a term in the wrestling business. Everyone else is sort of a mid-card geek. I mean, Dolph Ziggler, The Miz, even Sheamus, who got a decent run, Ryback, who was literally like being built up as the next Goldberg. But, you know, all these guys, once they started to get some real momentum behind them, they cut their legs out, they had them do other things, you know, they jobbed them out, because, again, they didn't want to hold anyone up to leave them high and dry. But as a result, now you really don't have any stars. I mean, Cena is probably going to get his rematch, and I fear that Cena's probably, I'm afraid Cena might actually do the comeback thing and win, which would suck.
Yeah.
But I'm just trying to think of, you know, from everything I've heard, Lesnar is going to be the champ going into WrestleMania 31 to face Roman Reigns. And he's got to have people to fight before Roman Reigns is sort of deemed ready. And outside of Lesnar, Orton, there's really no one else. The two other big imposing guys, I mean, there's Rusev, the Russian guy who's been booked to be a monster too. But the thing is that if you have Lesnar destroy him, then that pretty much destroys Rusev, and you really want to keep Rusev around as a mid-card threat, so you can't really neuter him. And so you got like the other two guys who physically could like stand up to Lesnar are Big Show and Mark Henry, and Lesnar has beaten both of them convincingly before. So I'm really kind of struggling in terms of who he could fight. Like, maybe a program of Randy Orton if they did it right. Maybe Dean Ambrose or Seth Rollins from the former Shield. Other than that, you know, WWE, this is what you get for not actually making stars over the past decade. I mean, you've had plenty of opportunities.
What, you mean WWE made bad business decisions? Get the fuck out.
Yeah. I mean, again, if they can get Bautista back for a pay-per-view or two, that would be a huge thing, because I think Bautista, at least physically, would look like Brock's equal. So that would be an interesting thing. And Brock and Bautista kind of debuted around the same time, 10 years or so ago. So having and they both kind of had similar builds, and they both kind of had the same thing, Bautista being managed by Ric Flair, Lesnar being managed by Paul Heyman. So they were kind of mirrors of each other in a lot of ways, and they never fought. So Lesnar versus Batista could be interesting if done right, but I'm not seeing anyone else in the WWE's current, you know, roster of full-timers who would pose a legitimate threat. Unless they play into that, and the next 8 months is basically just, you know, a bunch of losers willingly standing up to get slaughtered. And they just have Brock Lesnar tear through the locker room before Roman Reigns is ready.
They might could do a thing maybe with Lesnar versus multiple opponents.
Well, I mean, that would be the thing, to put him in maybe some six-man matches, maybe some fatal four-ways or triple threats. But, I mean, what's really interesting is that Brock Lesnar, I mean, at least in terms of storyline, Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman, they really don't get along with Triple H. In fact, one of Lesnar's programs over the past year or two had been with Triple H. He had 3 matches with him. Triple H won 2, Lesnar won 1, which was kind of absurd in and of itself. But basically, at the end of the day, Lesnar and Triple H have never really seen eye to eye. And the whole point of this was Triple H was so desperate to get the championship off of Cena that he kind of hired Lesnar to do it. And so an interesting storyline would be Triple H being unable to control Lesnar now that he's the champion and just going through everyone he can find to try to stop him. And of course, Triple H was instrumental in the breakup of the Shield, which included Roman Reigns. So that would be interesting if he finally has to turn to Roman Reigns to sort of stop the monster he unleashed.
Fire everything.
No, pretty much, yeah. And I mean, that would be an interesting storyline. But then it would make Triple H look like he's desperate, and that wouldn't be good because Triple H is not allowed to look bad in any sense of the word. So, you know.
Too late for that. I mean, I don't know. He's as much of an unlikable asshole as Vince is, so, you know.
He is. But that was SummerSlam. Brock Lesnar turned John Cena into a pile of, what was it, blood, vomit, and urine?
Indeed.
So, you know, they had to scrape John Cena off of the mat with a spatula afterwards. And so that was SummerSlam. Very interesting, very historic show, again, because it's something you really don't see in a world title match. It's not something you see with the top star of the company. In fact, I'd almost say it's worth it. It's not a bad show in and of itself. The other matches on the show, like, nothing was bad, really. There was no match that was just, ugh. The Chris Jericho-Bray Wyatt match was a bit of a downer because it just shows how old Chris Jericho is. And I love Chris Jericho, but Jericho just cannot go in the ring anymore. And I think that match really kind of showed it. He was slow. But other than that, the show was good. So I'm not going to say buy SummerSlam, you know, just to see that one show, just to see the final match. But, you know, I definitely would recommend seeing it because of that final match, because it is historic. It is historic. And the rest of the card is entertaining in its own right. So it's not like you're going to feel ripped off, especially if you have the network now. The network now available in all countries.
$9.99.
Except in Canada. Canada, it's $11.99.
Uh-huh.
But we've got this weird version of the network up here with Rogers Cable. I'm not sure how it works yet. But basically, not to pimp the network, but I'm just saying, like, if you want to see SummerSlam, and maybe you're really only interested in seeing John Cena get his head kicked in, then the network's definitely a good means to do that, because you'll be able to see it, you know, for a relatively cheap price. You won't be, like, paying $55 for one 16-minute match. So if you have a means to see this pay-per-view without breaking the bank, I would definitely recommend it just to see the main event. It is legitimately something you don't see every day in pro wrestling. And it almost had the shock of The Undertaker, because when The Undertaker lost, no one could believe it when the ref counted to three. And here, I almost didn't believe it when Cena got pinned. Like, I was sort of expecting Lesnar to win, but John Cena matches tend to follow the Hulk Hogan formula where he gets the crap kicked out of him and then he, like, has his comeback and then he wins. And I was expecting, like, maybe John Cena would have this huge comeback and then Lesnar would eke out a win. But no, there was no comeback. Lesnar just kicked his ass for 16 minutes and then pinned him. And I was shocked. So, you know, John Cena, your antics do not amuse Brock Lesnar. So, definitely see SummerSlam. At least see the main event if you have a means to do that. Because, damn, you're probably not going to see a world title match like that for a long, long time.
It's just a good, fun ass kicking.
Yeah, seeing John Cena writhe in pain is always cathartic.
Indeed.
But we're going to finish things up. Just a brief talk about Doctor Who. Doctor Who Season 8 of the updated series debuts this Saturday. And
how does this make you feel?
I'm excited. I am excited. I'm excited to see Peter Capaldi, because the thing about it is that Stephen Moffat has kind of said that he's always favored the Doctor being an older kind of guy.
Right.
And Matt Smith really only got the job in the first place because he just blew everyone away at the auditions. But John Hurt as the War Doctor in the 50th anniversary special was really sort of Moffat's first chance to really write a Doctor the way he would prefer to write him.
Right. And I liked it.
And I liked it too. And now, so we're getting Peter Capaldi, who's an older guy, for a full run. So I'm interested to see how that's going to play out. The trailers haven't been very revealing as to what's going to happen. We do know that there is one where the Doctor asks, "Am I a good man?" And that seems to hint that he's still going to be struggling with his regeneration. The Doctor is usually a bit wonky after he regenerates. Has a bit of an identity crisis, which is understandable. And some of the stills that have been released show a very Victorian look. So I'm going to guess that they probably go back in time, some sort of shenanigans in Victorian London. But from what I'm gathering, it also seems as if, like, they've kind of revealed his outfit. And that's actually kind of a big deal for Doctor Who fans, because each Doctor sort of has his own style in how he dresses, and that kind of helps define who he is. And Peter Capaldi's outfit in this seems to be a toned-down version of the Third Doctor's outfit. And the Third Doctor was an older guy, very gentlemanly, but he could kick ass. Like, he knew martial arts, so it was like this old British guy who was, like, pulling out kung fu moves on aliens.
Nice.
It was actually kind of interesting. In fact, I'd say that if you insist on watching Doctor Who from start to finish, the Third Doctor is really where it starts to get good. The first two Doctors are revered for their place in history, but the show, in my opinion, really doesn't get good until the Third Doctor. And Peter Capaldi's outfit, at least, seems to be a throwback to that, given, of course, that he is an older guy. I'm hoping that that carries on in more ways than one. And if that's the case, I'm excited. Again, not much to say in terms of plot, because nothing's really been revealed. All we really know is that Victorian England is probably going to be a setting for at least one story, and that it will probably follow up from the end of the last season, where the TARDIS was spiraling out of control just as the Doctor regenerated, and the Doctor, in his regenerative haze, has forgotten how to fly it. So that should be fun.
Well, that happens, you know.
Oh, the Doctor's always a bit wonky. You know, he took like a nap for like 5 days after he went from Christopher Eccleston to David Tennant. Well, after he commented that his teeth felt different, and then he was like, Barcelona. And then he went to like, then he like fell asleep for 5 days and then woke up. But that, you know, that's something else entirely. Point being, I'm excited. Nothing to really expand upon other than saying I really hope this kind of lives up to what we saw from the 50th anniversary kind of with John Hurt. Because John Hurt's doctor in that kind of rejected a lot of the youthful silliness that David Tennant and Matt Smith had really been showing.
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, I don't necessarily dislike that style, but we've had it for two doctors now, and it's time to maybe cleanse the palate a bit with kind of an older guy. And if Peter Capaldi's going to be written more or less along the lines that John Hurt was written in, then yeah, sign me up. I hope it's a good run. But oh, also we know there's going to be a T-Rex in London at some point.
Woot! Yeah, I'll watch it for that.
So yeah, Doctor Who debuts on Saturday. I'm psyched. I'm also psyched for the opening credits because each doctor kind of gets his own version of the opening credits. So except for Eccleston and Tennant, who shared the same one, but you know, it'll be cool. I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully by our next show, I'll have more to talk about it. I'll at least have one episode under our belts to sort of, you know, pontificate on. But I'm very positive going forward. Matt Smith's run got a lot of, undeserved hate, I think, near the end. So if they can combine Matt Smith, kind of storytelling that Matt Smith had with kind of a more mature doctor, then I'm all for it.
Yeah, I did not care for, well, I definitely did not care for Tennant. I thought he was just annoying.
Mm-hmm.
Matt Smith, a little bit less offensive, but it felt like this, this is going to sound really dumb because it is essentially what's happening, but it felt like a different guy playing the exact same character.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a different incarnation of the same character.
Yeah, it's definitely been pointed out that the three modern doctors that we've had so far have been Eccleston, Tennant, and Smith. And obviously, Capaldi has really yet to debut, so I'm not really counting him quite yet. But of those three, Tennant and Smith are closer than either of them were to Eccleston. And so I think kind of, again, that's what I said, we've had the same kind of more or less similar character for two incarnations now, and it's going to be good to change things up a bit.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I liked Eccleston. Tennant couldn't stand. Smith can tolerate. So, you know, this guy might get me to watch a little more often.
Mm-hmm. So, let me ask you, just out of curiosity, someone who really isn't as well versed in Doctor Who as some other people are.
Okay.
You said that you felt that Tennant and Smith were pretty much playing the same character, the same kind of version of the character, that there really wasn't much difference between the 10th and the 11th Doctors. Yet you said that you couldn't stand Tennant and you could tolerate Smith. What made Smith more tolerable?
He acted a little bit less retarded. I basically felt that the differences between the two characters were negligible, yet at the same time, Smith's take on it seemed to be a little bit less annoying.
Okay.
And I could deal with that a lot better than Tennant, who just seemed to be just, hi, I'm kooky and I'm random and I'm whatever, love me! So, you know. That was kind of my take on Tennant's version of it. Smith was more like, hey, I'm here, I'm kind of kooky, and I'm somewhat random, and if you like me, that'd be really cool.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
That's pretty much it. I mean, you know, I'm sure there's a lot of people who will take objection to that. But,
oh, there definitely will be.
Whatever.
There definitely will be. Well, most people tend to like Eccleston's season that he had. The current version of Doctor Who really got big with Tennant, and Tennant was the Doctor for 5 years. So to a lot of people, Tennant is their definitive version of the Doctor. And it's really weird because to a lot of older fans who watched the original show, Tom Baker was the definitive doctor. He was the doctor for 7 years. He was the guy with the...
Right, the fro and the scarf.
The fro and the scarf, yes. And so he was the doctor for 7 years, and he was the definitive one. And I don't necessarily have anything against either one of them, but I wouldn't put either in terms of my favorite, just kind of personal preferences. I always preferred... Tom Baker was the fourth doctor. I always preferred the third or the fifth to the fourth. And I've always kind of preferred Eccleston and Smith to Tennant's. And I look forward to Capaldi. And again, nothing against Tennant. I don't have the same dislike that Jack has of him, but mostly because in a lot of ways, Eccleston was the first doctor I really started watching. And so, you know, when so the first regeneration I saw was Eccleston to Tennant. And I kind of had that reaction where he turned into David Tennant. And I'm like, who the hell is this ass clown?
Yeah.
He's like, I'm the doctor. I'm like, bullshit, you're not the doctor.
Yeah, it's kind of like, okay, here's my thoughts on this, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, Tennant evidently, you know, that's when the show kind of became quote-unquote mainstream over here in the States. And it was when, you know, Tennant was playing the doctor. And I wonder, you know, you've had Tennant, then you've had Smith, which I think was a very conservative departure mm-hmm. from Tennant in terms of more or less the same character, just portrayed differently. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of wondering, you know, if a lot of these new fans here in the States that have signed on will be like, you know, they conceptually understand that the nature of, you know, the entity that is the doctor and how he does things, you know, regeneration, but when they actually have to deal with such a contrast in from what they're used to, if they're going to stick.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting.
Because, I mean, the Doctor Who here in America, in the United States, it doesn't have that same, I guess, status as
legacy,
it does
maybe.
In the UK. Well, in the sense of it's an institution. It's almost over in the UK and I guess the Commonwealth in general, what Star Trek kind of is to us.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, there are Americans who will give any fucking Star Trek a shot.
Voyager lasted 7 seasons, for fuck's sake.
Right, exactly. And I wonder if that same patience, I don't know if Doctor Who has garnered that much goodwill here.
It's going to be interesting. Because you actually did see a lot of that when Peter Capaldi was announced as the next Doctor. You had a lot, I don't want to stereotype anyone, but mostly female fans.
Yeah.
Saying, well, he's not hot. And I'm like, were you even watching with Eccleston? Like, Eccleston is not an ugly man by any stretch of the imagination, but he's not like the teen heartthrob that Tennant and Smith were.
No.
So it's like, it's kind of like, bitch, do you even Doctor Who properly?
Well, obviously they don't. you know. But, and that's the thing, it's like, you know, is that departure to, you know, from Tennant to Smith to Capaldi, you know, how many American fans are going to give it a shot instead of just being like, I know, like, different. I mean, which is essentially what I did with Tennant. Well, I know, like, ass clown, but, you know.
That's kind of
my thing with the show is that with me, it hasn't garnered that much of goodwill with me to, I'm not invested enough in that show to where if they have a doctor that I don't like, that I'm going to keep watching. It's like one of those things where if you have a doctor that
to be fair, it wasn't with the British because god damn it, people stopped watching when Colin Baker became the sixth doctor.
That's the Technicolor Dreamcoat guy, right?
Yeah.
Well, that's not a fan preference thing. That's a self-preservation thing. That's a, I don't want my eyes to do this or my television set cannot handle this.
My television set just fizzes when I turn it on.
Yeah. No, dude, no lie. Like, okay. When they were doing the 50th anniversary, I had some of it on here on BBC America and I was watching it, and that was before I moved the big screen in here, and I had a, you know, one of the old CRT TVs in here, one of the fatbacks, and, you know, whenever that dude was on the screen, like, his coat would just do all kinds of weird wavy lines on the fucking colors. And I heard my TV, like, I can hear high pitches very well. And it doesn't take much of a high pitch to really annoy me, as you well know. Mm-hmm. And, like, my TV would just start, it would alter pitch when he would be on the screen. It was physically stressful on my television to display that. What the fuck? And maybe some of the people who were watching could literally no longer watch because their television just fucking shat the bed.
The television was just like, no! Nope.
I mean, we're talking in like the 70s here or 80s, something, man. 80s.
80s, yeah, Colin Baker.
Well, still
was
though, in the 80s, okay, look, well now, in early 80s, my grandmother had a black and white TV. A lot of people in the 80s had like old ass TVs. And now, me having a black and white TV in that case is probably a blessing. But like my mother's TV, which would have been, you know, cause my mother being the artist insisted on having a color television. You know, I can imagine watching it on one of those old TV sets from the 80s and wondering, you know, would it handle it? You know, like if you actually had the TV set in the 80s, you probably bought it in like the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was how TVs were back then. Mm-hmm. And Jesus, I wonder, man. Or maybe it's just these, you know, later cheaper TVs they've been making, but it physically put a strain on my television.
But yes, back to your original point, I am interested to see how many of the fan base who kind of grew attached to the idea of the Doctor as sort of this attractive young man will deal now that we've got an old angry Scotsman playing the Doctor.
I, for one, welcome our old angry Scottish overlords.
He's probably going to be, I really hope they play up the just, I don't want to say bitterness, but just the don't give a fuckness. Like anyone who's seen Capaldi's work knows that he's a foul mouthed comedian. So if we see more of that, then yes, I'd like to see the Doctor maybe, you know, just insult people with curse words.
I think more shows could use that. But the right people being insulted.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, you know, I'll give it a watch. You know, I've said that from the beginning. I do not in any way, shape, or form consider myself to be a Doctor Who fan. But I see enough appeal in the character. It providing this following circumstances are met. A, you know, the new character is kind of what I expect him to be, according to what you've said. And B, they curb the fucking Daleks and Cybermen down a notch or two, at least a little bit.
The
to where
Daleks,
I don't see them every other episode.
I think the Daleks are going to be in the first episode. I remember seeing one of like the 16-second spots to hype the new season, and I think there was a Dalek presence in it. Again, the current agreement with the guy who owns the intellectual property of the Daleks says that they have to be used at least once a season or else they can't use them.
Right, but can we just use them once a season or maybe twice? Once or twice maybe?
Mm-hmm.
A little less.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to see them play up on like, you know, what happened with Gallifrey and all this other shit.
Oh, they're definitely, I definitely, they can't just leave Gallifrey hanging.
Because I thought that was kind of interesting, this concept of an entire planet being caught in like this protective space-time bubble. I thought that was really cool, and I'd like to see more of that. And less, you know, pepper shakers from hell.
Well, I do think, I don't know if this has been confirmed or not, this is just kind of me speculating, but the upcoming season will probably feature the search for Gallifrey as a central premise. I mean, that's at least what I would guess. It was, they hinted at it. I mean, obviously it was the plot point in the 50th anniversary special, and they hinted at it in Time of the Doctor, which was Smith's last episode. that, you know, Gallifrey was still out there. So I think we're going to see a lot of that. The search for Gallifrey will definitely be a thing. And, of course, we'll probably get, no, Doctor, your Gallifrey is in another castle a few times.
Yeah, most likely.
But with that, this has been episode 28 of Basically a Geek Show. Of course, Stitcher, Spreaker, iTunes, YouTube, basicallyasportsshow.com. Always.
Your bathroom window.
Indeed. All places where you can catch us. You can send us an email, basicallyageekshow@gmail.com, on Twitter @ageekshow. And on top of that, I think that's it for the plugs. Oh, yeah. Also, if you want to interact with us online in terms of forums, we're posting at sportslogos.net, the forum there under the lounge section, basically a sports show forum, on the Basically a Geek Show thread at TFW 2005 under Transformers videos, and of course at Taijitu.org forums for nation states under general discussion. We've got a Geek Show thread there.
The actual URL for that is forum.taijitu.org.
Forum.taijitu.org. Awesome. So if you want to hook up with us online, just like ask us a question on a message board, those are your places to do so. But this has been episode 28, Basically a Geek Show. For Jack, this is Mike, signing off.
Good night, everybody.